Our next speaker, our final speaker, is Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie Cohn lectures throughout the world on international human rights and United States foreign policy. A news consultant for CBS News and a legal analyst for Court TV, she also provides legal and political commentary on BBC, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, NPR, and Pacifica Radio. Professor Cohn writes columns for Los Angeles Daily Journal and San Francisco Daily Journal, and she is also a contributing editor to Jurist and Guild Practitioner. She has been a criminal defense attorney at the trial and appellate levels for many years. Professor Cohn is president-elect of the National Lawyers Guild, co-chair of the Guild's International Committee, and the United States representative to the Executive Committee of the American Association of Jurists. Professor Cohn could easily be considered a leading spokesperson for the national and international issues that VFP espouses. She is speaking out for Lieutenant Aaron Watada and has been vocal in supporting Cindy Sheehan and Jose Padilla. She has spoken out against abuses at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, Bush's war crimes, and the government's failures during Katrina. You can read her articles on Counterpunch, Alternet, and Common Dreams. We are blessed to have such a powerful spokesperson to close out our convention on Saturday evening. Professor Cohn's talk will be entitled Support the Troops. Please join me in welcoming Professor Marjorie Cohn.
First, I want to say that I was very honored when Lieutenant Aaron Watada called me and asked me to come support him and speak at his news conference, where he officially announced, publicly announced, his resistance to the illegal orders to go to Iraq. I also am very grateful to be in the company of Camilo Mejia, another courageous resistor. As well as my good friend Fernando Suarez del Solar, who is sitting right over here. Fernando lives in San Diego, where I live, and Fernando's son Jesus was the first Latino to be killed in Iraq. And since that time, Fernando has spent every waking hour speaking out, traveling all around the world, speaking out, trying to stop this war. Thank you, Fernando. I also want to say that my father, who fought in World War II, and my husband, who was in the Navy during Vietnam, are proud members of Veterans for Peace. From 1964 to 1973, the United States government assaulted the small country of Vietnam to preserve a corrupt South Vietnamese regime. U.S. warplanes dropped 7 million tons of bombs on Vietnam and used 400,000 tons of napalm and vast quantities of Agent Orange. Between 2 and 3 million Indochinese died in the war. 58,000 American soldiers were killed, and 300,000 were wounded. Many still suffer the effects of Agent Orange and post-traumatic stress disorder. More Vietnam veterans have committed suicide since the war than the number of soldiers who died in the war. GIs established underground newspapers and set up coffee houses where they met and discussed politics and strategies for resistance. Mass protests were held. In Vietnam, frustrated, angry enlisted men killed their officers at the rate of once a week in incidents known as fragging. Many GIs were prosecuted. Soldiers felt betrayed by their government. More than 500,000 deserted. An estimated 200,000 were conscientious objectors. 50,000 fled to Canada to avoid the draft. The revelation of massive war crimes by U.S. troops during the 1968 My Lai massacre turned GIs against the war. They realized that it was U.S. policy that created My Lai. There were free fire zones in Vietnam in which civilians were fair targets. Today, the Marines operate in weapons-free zones, which means they can shoot whatever they see. This policy violates the Geneva Conventions. It is a war crime, and this policy is set at the top, the commander-in-chief. Just as American soldiers were trained to think of the North Vietnamese as gooks, U.S. troops are now programmed to kill the Hajis in Iraq. The objectification of the non-white enemy makes it more palatable to kill and abuse them. The torture documented at Abu Ghraib, as well as in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, and the killing of civilians at Haditha and many other places throughout Iraq, have created opposition to the war within the military. The many soldiers who feel that George W. Bush lied to them about why they went to war are a microcosm of the American public, a majority of which opposes the war. The U.S. government tried to justify the Vietnam War with its domino theory. If Vietnam fell to the communists, so would the other countries in Southeast Asia. That, of course, never happened. Once Bush's weapons of mass destruction rationale was exposed, he began using a similar myth to rationalize his invasion of Iraq. A democratic Iraq would inspire other countries in the Middle East to jump on board. But democracy was never Bush's goal in Iraq. We know what Bush thinks of democracy. We know what he thinks of what Jimmy Carter called the most democratic election he ever saw, which was the Palestinian election that elected Hamas. We know what Bush thinks of the democratically elected representatives from Hezbollah in Lebanon. And we know what George W. Bush thinks of democratic elections when they don't elect him as president. Democracy was never Bush's goal in Iraq, nor was finding Osama bin Laden his aim when he invaded Afghanistan. The U.S. is constructing between 6 and 14 permanent military bases in Iraq. They never have no intent ever to leave Iraq. And a natural gas pipeline deal was concluded shortly after the U.S. conquered Afghanistan, coincidentally. In search of new sites for military bases to dominate the region, Bush will probably invade other sovereign nations, such as Iran, he's already making the plans, Syria, by the way, the Jerusalem Post reported that Israel doesn't want to invade Syria, but the U.S. is pressuring them to invade Syria, and North Korea. The shortage of U.S. troops will become even more acute. During Vietnam, the draft energized students to oppose the war. Hell no, we won't go, I think was the total, the complete. There's no draft today as there was in the 1960s and 1970s. Soldiers and sailors voluntarily enlisted. Of course, many of them knew they were going to be drafted, so they voluntarily enlisted. Today, we have a poverty draft. Military recruiters target poor kids with few options. Desperate to meet their enlistment quotas, recruiters frequently lie to get youth to enlist. They hype the perks, but never talk about killing and being killed. By allowing the Pentagon to collect personal data on high school and college kids, the No Child Left Behind Act aims to ensure that no child is left behind when the ships sail for Iraq. But the single greatest obstacle to military recruitment is parents. They're organizing to save their children. And this is one of Fernando Suarez del Solar's main programs in his life's work. He works in the schools and organizes against military recruitment. Grievances against the war in Iraq, like opposition to the Vietnam War, go beyond disapproval of the war itself. Many GIs object to the oppressive, authoritarian culture promoted in the military. That atmosphere was exacerbated by racism in the armed forces during Vietnam. Blacks were drafted and therefore dying in disproportionate numbers. They held the grunt positions. They didn't just work in the boiler room. They were the niggers in the boiler room, and I put niggers in quotes. They were the cannon fodder on the front lines with the highest rate of casualties. Besides racism, sexism and homophobia were and still are actively fostered by the military establishment. They in turn contribute to the brutalization mentality that prepares GIs for war. Unable to muster enough troops to fight in the war because they believe in it, the military exploits sex, masculinity, and sexual violence to motivate the future killers. The brutal tone is set at the top. The brutalized become the brutalizers. The torture inflicted by many U.S. servicemen and women in the prisons of Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay is the product of dehumanizing, brutal conditioning and policies that begin at the top of the chain of command. And I don't want to keep reminding you because I know that you know who's at the top of the chain of command. George W. Bush. As in the Vietnam War era, large numbers of soldiers are returning from Iraq with severe mental problems, many with post-traumatic stress disorder. There are many forms of resistance to military service. Some protest the war while still serving in the armed forces. Others seek to get out, often actively organizing others to oppose the war once they succeed. Some speak out peacefully, others engage in militant action. Many file for conscientious objector status, claiming opposition not just to the Iraq War, but to all war. Not all resistors display the same level of militancy. A silent form of opposition was part of a tidal wave of resistance that developed throughout the course of the Vietnam War. Some GIs quietly complained in churches about what the military was teaching them. In Vietnam, one soldier stopped taking his malaria medicine, contracted malaria, and was shipped home. His was a quiet but effective form of individual resistance to the war. Many GIs began to salute trash cans or mail dead fish to particularly loathsome officers. Others joined in rebellions, such as the one on the San Diego-based USS Constellation in 1972. Racism was rampant throughout the military. Trained to objectify the North Vietnamese as gooks, many black GIs began to realize that a gook was the same thing as a nigger. Black crew members on the Constellation formed an organization to defend against discrimination in promotion and the administration of military justice. The command retaliated by singling out several of the leaders and giving them less than honorable and administrative discharges. More than 100 sailors, black and white, staged a sit-in and demanded the ship's commander hear their grievances. 130 men refused to board the ship. They held a militant dockside strike, often called the largest act of mass disobedience in naval history. None of the men was arrested. Some received early discharges. Others were reassigned to shore duty. The Constellation Rebellion captured the attention of the United States military brass. Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Elmo Zumwalt met with 80 top admirals and Marine Corps generals. The House Armed Services Committee appointed a special subcommittee to investigate the discipline problems in the Navy. The Constellation incident was evidence of both a new awareness of racism in the Navy and resistance to the war itself. There is a burgeoning support network among the high-profile resistors to the Iraq War. Camilo Mejia, who I said is here tonight, Pablo Paredes, who I think wanted to be here but could not. I think he's helping his fellow resistor back in San Diego. Aiden Delgado, Jeremy Hinsman, Kevin Benderman, and Aaron Watada, as well as many others, have refused orders to fight in Iraq, claiming the war is illegal. As soldiers and sailors follow them in increasing numbers and refuse to obey similar orders, military resistance to the war will grow. Camilo Mejia, a former Army infantryman who spent 9 months in the brig for refusing to return to Iraq after a military leave, was charged with desertion with intent to avoid hazardous duty. Camilo's case achieved notoriety because he was the first Iraq veteran to see combat, return on furlough, and then publicly refuse to return to Iraq. Camilo denounced the war as illegal. Aiden Delgado, who received conscientious objector status and an honorable discharge after spending 9 months in Iraq, worked at the battalion headquarters at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison. Aiden saw prisoners beaten within an inch of their lives by guards. Five were shot dead by throwing stones during a demonstration. Although Abu Ghraib was routinely shelled with mortars and rockets from the insurgency, it's really the resistance, it's not the insurgency. Any country that's being invaded by a foreign occupier is going to resist. It's the Bush administration that calls it the insurgency, and I apologize for that slip. Aiden was denied protective armor after he declared himself to be a conscientious objector. Jeremy Hinsman also maintained the Iraq War was illegal. He left the Army and went to Canada after his conscientious objector application was denied. During the Vietnam War, 50,000 draft-age Americans went to Canada to avoid serving in what many characterized as an illegal and immoral war. Many were granted refugee status. Canadian immigration rules are much tighter now. Nevertheless, many who are AWOL from the Iraq War are laying low in Canada. At least that's what people say. Kevin Benderman was sentenced to 15 months for refusing to return to Iraq. Kevin's company commander in Iraq ordered his outfit to shoot children if they threw small rocks at the soldiers. When he received orders to return to Iraq for a second tour of duty, Kevin refused deployment and applied for conscientious objector status. The Army rewarded him with a charge of desertion. Kevin's case has become a cause célèbre, inspiring others to resist this illegal war. The turning point for Lieutenant Aaron Watada came when he saw the pain and suffering, this is a quote from him, pain and suffering of so many soldiers and their families and innocent Iraqis. Not a publicity seeker, Aaron tried twice to privately resign his commission earlier this year, but the Army refused to let him go quietly. So Aaron held a news conference in Tacoma where he announced that the Iraq War is illegal and his participation would make him a party to war crimes. The Army is trying very, very hard to dissuade others from following in Aaron's footsteps. The Army charged him with 3 articles of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, 2 counts of contempt towards officials, specifically George W. Bush, 3 counts of conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, and 1 count of missing movement. If convicted on all 6 charges by a general court-martial, Aaron could be sentenced to over 7 years in military prison. Aaron's pretrial hearing is set for August 17th. On August 18th, 16th is the national day. I think it's the 16th. 16th. There is a national day of education to support Aaron, the 16th. It's the 16th of August. National day of education to support Aaron Watada and educate people about the illegality of the war in Iraq. I was also lucky to be asked by Pablo Paredes to participate in his case, and I want to tell you a bit about that case. Pablo refused to facilitate the transportation of troops to participate in the Iraq War. When he refused orders to deploy with the ship, Pablo took a tremendous risk. He had no way of knowing whether he would be charged with desertion, which carries a possible death sentence, although no executions for desertion had been carried out since World War II. He could receive a dishonorable discharge that would haunt him the rest of his life. Pablo faced possible incarceration, forfeiture of all salary and benefits, and a criminal record that might affect his future job opportunities. And he could become the subject of harassment, ridicule, humiliation, and even physical abuse from many who could not understand his protest. Pablo was ordered to board the Bonhomme Richard and deliver Marines to fight in Iraq. Had he gone, Pablo would have remained on the ship, far from harm's way. Rather, he said, quote, "It came down to being part of a system that could hurt people." Pablo agonized about what to do. He considered hurting himself, breaking a bone, an arm, or a leg, or asking a friend to do it for him. He could show up drunk or on drugs, even though he had never done drugs. He was desperate to avoid becoming part of the war machine. Finally, Pablo decided he would simply refuse to go. Mindful of the potential to inspire the peace movement, Pablo contacted the media. He donned his T-shirt, which said, what did it say? Like a cabinet member, and then on the back it said, "I refuse." You know, it was when all those cabinet members were abandoning the Bush 1 ship or George the 1st ship after the first term. So Pablo put on his T-shirt and appeared on the Navy Pier in San Diego on December 6th of 2004. Not knowing what fate was in store for him, Pablo refused orders to board the ship bound for the Persian Gulf. Pablo was charged with unauthorized absence and missing movement by design. He was court-martialed. At one point during Pablo's trial, and I was there at the time, participants and spectators were standing around outside during a recess. A car drove up. This was on the base, the military base, Navy base. A car drove up, and a sailor leaped out of the car and ran up to Pablo. "Are you Paredes?" he asked. He appeared hostile. It looked like he was going to assault Pablo. The crowd cringed. "Yes," Pablo said. The sailor thrust out his hand and said, "I want to shake your hand." Lieutenant Commander Clant, presiding at Pablo's court-martial, dismissed the charge of unauthorized absence, but convicted Pablo of missing movement by design. Before sentencing, Pablo told the judge, "In all I read, I came to an overwhelming conclusion, supported by countless examples, that any soldier who knowingly participates in an illegal war can find no haven in the fact that they were following orders in the eyes of international law." And then he said, "If there is anything I could be guilty of, it is my belief. I am guilty of believing war in all forms is immoral and useless. And I am guilty of believing that as a service member, I have a duty to refuse to participate in this war because it is illegal," unquote. These statements provided both the basis for conscientious objector status, which is opposition to all war, and Pablo's belief that the Iraq War in particular was illegal. He also said, "I am convinced that the current war on Iraq is illegal. I am also convinced that the true causality for it lacked any high ground in the topography of morality. I believe, as a member of the armed forces, beyond having a duty to my chain of command and my president, I have a higher duty to my conscience and to the supreme law of the land. Both of these higher duties dictate that I must not participate in any way, hands-on or indirect, in the current aggression that has been unleashed on Iraq. In order to corroborate the reasonableness of Pablo's anti-war beliefs, he asked me to testify as an expert witness for the defense on the illegality of the Iraq War and on the commission of war crimes by U.S. forces. I told the judge that the war in Iraq violates the United Nations Charter, which forbids a country from attacking another country unless it is acting in self-defense or has the approval of the Security Council. And I'm going to quote from my testimony. Since the invasion of Kuwait 11 to 12 years before Operation Iraqi Freedom, Iraq had not invaded any country, and Iraq was not a threat to any country, including the United States. Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction, and that was clear. Many weapons inspectors said that at the time. There was no link between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein's regime, or Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's regime. There was no imminent threat of any attack against the United States or any other member of the United Nations, and therefore, I said, it was not carried out in self-defense under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter. Furthermore, I told the judge that the Security Council did not sanction the United States' use of force in Iraq. In fact, this is what I said, just before the invasion of Iraq, the United States tried mightily to get the Security Council to pass a resolution authorizing the war, but they refused to do it. I explained that Pablo had a reasonable belief that transporting Marines to Iraq would put them in the position of committing war crimes. The U.S. War Crimes Statute defines grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions as war crimes. Torture, inhuman treatment, willful killing, and the denial of a right to a fair trial constitute grave breaches and therefore war crimes. The torture and abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib in Iraq by U.S. forces constitute war crimes. Beginning with the shock and awe of the first dropping of the 2,000-pound bombs on civilian areas constituted willful killing and a war crime under Geneva. The forced deportation of 200,000 citizens of Fallujah and the retaliatory attack on Fallujah and the destruction of a hospital also amounted to war crimes. And I just want to take a brief moment to recognize someone else in our audience who is an incredible reporter and messenger for the anti-war movement and for the world, and that is Dar Jamal, who just came back from Lebanon and Syria. And I think we should give him all a hand. And he wrote daily reports. He was there as the Israeli bombs were dropping all around him, and he was writing, and he was interviewing, and he was bringing the truth to us, and he is a really critical, critical part of our anti-war movement. Both the Nuremberg Principles and the Uniform Code of Military Justice establish a duty to obey lawful orders, but also establish a duty to disobey unlawful orders. I told the judge that in the UCMJ, it's not just the commission of war crimes or crimes against the peace or crimes against humanity that is punishable, but also complicity in the commission of those crimes. In criminal law, which is one of the things I teach, we call it aiding and abetting. So even if someone were not personally to go to Iraq and commit war crimes, if that person were transporting someone to Iraq to commit war crimes, he would be liable for the war crimes just the same as the person who actually committed the war crimes. And because orders to board that ship and transport Marines to fight in an illegal war and possibly commit war crimes were unlawful, I told the judge, Pablo therefore had a duty to refuse those unlawful orders to embark on the Bonhomme Richard on December 6, 2004. At the conclusion of my testimony, and after an inept cross-examination by Navy prosecutor Lieutenant J.S. Freeman, Judge Clant made a statement that astonished the spectators. I believe, he said, The government, I believe the government, has successfully demonstrated a reasonable belief for every service member to decide that the wars in Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and Iraq were illegal to fight in. Rick Rogers, the military reporter for the conservative San Diego Union-Tribune, he's very right-wing, he characterized the judge's surprising statement as a flip comment. Well, lieutenant commanders presiding at Navy courts-martial don't make flip comments. Nevertheless, apparently at Rogers' suggestion, the media representatives covering Pablo's trial agreed among themselves not to report the judge's statement. Only after I wrote an article for Truth Out, and which was picked up by many web publications and was finally picked up by the San Francisco Chronicle, did it even get out in the public. But Navy prosecutor Lieutenant B.T. Hale asked the judge to sentence Pablo to 9 months in the brig, forfeiture of pay and benefits, and a bad conduct discharge. Pablo could have, quote, this is the prosecutor talking, Pablo could have slinked away with his privately held beliefs quietly. According to Hale, the public nature of Pablo's protest made it more serious. Judge Clant gave Pablo Paredes no jail time or bad conduct discharge for missing his ship's movement to the Persian Gulf. Not every judge would do that, by the way. I just want to make sure you know that. Pablo was sentenced to 2 months restriction, 3 months of hard labor without confinement, and a reduction in rank to seaman recruit. When the judge announced the sentence, the spectators on both sides of the aisle were stunned. They checked with each other to make sure that they heard the judge correctly. And I was sitting next to Pablo's father, who speaks Spanish, and he didn't understand, and I was trying to explain in Spanish to him what I thought I had just heard, because we weren't quite sure that we had actually heard it correctly. But we had heard it correctly. The judge did not buy the prosecutor's argument that Pablo should be treated differently because his actions stemmed from political and moral beliefs. He must have felt tremendous pressure to incarcerate Pablo for his public defiance. But Judge Clant followed his own conscience and the law. He displayed remarkable courage. This is a huge victory, declared Pablo's lawyer, Jeremy Warren. A sailor can show up on a Navy base, refuse in good conscience to board a ship bound from Iraq, and receive no time in jail. Again, not every judge would do that. Warren, Jeremy Warren, a proud member of the National Lawyers Guild, I might add, added, Pablo's victory is an incredible boon to the anti-war movement. Since the day he refused to board that ship, Pablo has had a strong support network. And since his sentencing, he has become an inspiration, along with Camilo and Aiden and Kevin and Jeremy and all the rest, and Aaron now, to the burgeoning military resistance movement. Camilo Mejia and Aiden Delgado came to support Pablo during his court-martial. Fernando Suarez del Solar and Cindy Sheehan were there as well. Iraq Veterans Against the War, Gold Star Families Against the War, and Military Families Speak Out were also there. Since 2000, this is astounding. Since 2000, about 40,000 troops from all branches of the military have deserted, according to the Pentagon. 40,000. But Aaron Watada's lawyer, Eric Seitz, says they lied in Vietnam with the amount of opposition to the war, and they're lying now, which means it's probably much, much bigger. The refusers, the resistors, the deserters will increasingly put the Iraq war on trial in the media and on the internet. Soldiers, sailors, and parents of those killed, wounded, and still serving in Iraq have joined a growing movement of resistance to the war in Iraq. Some who oppose all war are conscientious objectors. As the war continues with no end in sight, and in fact it's getting more and more brutal and deadly every day, and casualties mount, The new GI movement will play a critical role in ending this war and in swelling the numbers of conscientious objectors. For all of them, unlike for many of us in America, the war is not an abstraction. 61% of Americans oppose the Iraq War. Joe Lieberman's defeat in Connecticut was a referendum on his support for the war. Dick Cheney immediately accused those who opposed Lieberman of undermining the war on terror. Karl Rove is brilliant. He is brilliant, I'm telling you. Coincidentally, Cheney's quote was a subheading on the front page of the New York Times the exact day that the big terrorist plot was foiled. It's a coincidence. They knew about it for months, okay? It wasn't going to happen tomorrow. It's a coincidence. This terrorizing of the population will continue through the November elections, but it is up to us to continue to speak truth to power, that the war in Iraq has made us less safe and more vulnerable to terror, and the United States' uncritical support for Israel's aggression against the Palestinian and Lebanese people is also incurring the wrath of millions of people around the world against the United States, making us less safe. As the tragedy Bush has created in Iraq continues to worsen, resistance to service will continue to grow. The best way to support our troops is to bring them home from Iraq, not at the end of the year, not in a year, but now, right now. The way to bring them home is the same way we brought our troops home from Vietnam. Congress must cut the funding for the war. And the only way that Congress is going to cut funding for the war, because Congress is so lily-livered that it hardly ever does anything but salute and march to Bush's fear-mongering, is for us to pressure Congress into cutting funding for the war. Vets can play a critical role in exposing the illegality and evil of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Many vets are returning from Iraq with combat-related illnesses and injuries, PTSD, traumatic injuries, neurological injuries, illness from depleted uranium, probably as yet underreported Gulf War syndrome, and many other problems. They come home to a military and a VA system that all too often punish them for their illness and deny them critical benefits. We see increasing numbers of bad paper vets, homeless vets, vets entangled in the criminal law system. The progressive movement has an opportunity, an obligation, to reach out to these vets, to help them demand the care they were promised, to help them stand up against the system that has harmed them and the Iraqi people. As during and after the Vietnam War, these veterans can become one of the most powerful voices against the war. And we saw them here in one of the most moving displays, standing behind Lieutenant Aaron Watada, that I can remember in recent history. I am very proud of the National Lawyers Guild's Military Law Task Force that helps administer the GI Rights Hotline, that publishes On Watch, that has done GI support work for many years. I congratulate Veterans for Peace on your fine work, and I thank you for honoring me with this invitation to address you.